Okay, fun seekers, yet another exciting, challenging presentation on mutual funds. What we're going to try to do in this presentation is get our arms around the industry. It's an impossible task. We are going to take a look at the most top level, so to speak, the broadest categories of mutual funds. There are many, many more, and to try to learn all of them is just impossible. But we'll learn the major categories. And what I want you to do is have a copy of the mutual fund scramble sheet, which you'll find in the chapter 4 section of the class webpage. There's a commentary that goes along with it. And what we do in the face-to-face class is we build this on the board from left to right and then refer to it often. So please do have this at your disposal. Whether you put it on your screen or print it out, it's up to you. But I'd have it easily within reach. And what we're going to do is we're going to go from the most riskiest stocks, the most riskiest mutual funds, which are stock funds, down to the least riskiest funds. All right? Okay, so let's get started on slide 41. The riskiest funds are aggressive growth funds. Well, actually, not really. There are one or two categories more aggressive than aggressive growth. You might see ultra or momentum. What do you think about this strategy, folks? You know, it can produce eye-popping returns, but what do we know about risk versus return? Indeed, one of them, one of the most riskiest, was Janus 20. Janus was the name, it still is the name of the mutual fund company. 20 is the name of the mutual fund. 20. Wait a minute. Does this ring a bell? Remember that a mutual fund must have at least 20 stocks or 20 bonds. They have to have at least 20 securities. They cannot have fewer than that. Indeed, Janus 20 said, we're going to just have 20. Now, I think a couple of times they went up to 25 or something like that. But we're going to concentrate our portfolio in a very small group of securities, in this case, stocks. Didn't work out so well. It worked out great while the market was going up. Indeed, worked out very poorly when the market's going down. And so I'm not a big fan of aggressive growth funds. Let me give you an analogy. I don't know if it works. If it works for you, great. If it doesn't, then just ignore what I'm going to say. But it works for me. I like to think of mutual funds as a buffet, right? That they're... You go to the buffet line, and you know you're at your table, and you go pick up a plate, and you go to the line. Do you load up your plate with jalapeno peppers, hot chili sauce? No, it's spice, a little bit, because this stuff can burn you, folks. It can burn you bad, and Joe. Investor who's looking at his portfolio of 401k mutual funds that he has at his disposal looks at the 10-year or lifetime return for the aggressive growth fund and sees that it has been the best of all the other funds in the bunch, puts all his money in his 401k into that fund, only to watch it fall 40s, 50s, 60% or more when the next major market downturn occurs, and then promptly takes it out and puts it in the money market fund because someone told them that that was the safest place to be just in time for the market to turn around and shoot back up. Is it too late to get in? Is it too late to get out? So if you put a little bit, you know, 5-10% of your portfolio into these guys, That's all. That's all you really need. You might want more. You might not want any. I don't have any, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't. You have to decide. The next major category are growth funds. Growth funds are mutual funds whose primary goal are capital gains and long-term growth. And in the prospectus, it'll say we typically invest in growth companies, high-growth companies. Now, they may or may not be as aggressive as the aggressive growth funds. You need to really know your fund, look at the turnover, read, listen to what the mutual fund managers say. Because a growth fund should do well over time, especially if it's well managed, but it's going to be more volatile than other funds, and not necessarily as volatile as an aggressive growth fund. So, again, we're still dealing with the spice. All right, here's where it starts to get tricky. The next major category is called capital appreciation funds. And if you look on the scramble sheet, you'll see that I tried to wrap the term capital appreciation fund around the aggressive growth funds, around the growth funds. Huh? What's the difference? I mean, growth, capital appreciation, aren't they the same? Not necessarily. As the saying, the song, ain't necessarily so. These are mutual funds that seek long-term growth of capital, capital being a fancy word for money, but they differ. As we said, a growth fund, aggressive growth fund, will say something along the lines that we will always strive to be 80 to 100% invested in high growth stocks. But a capital appreciation fund is often a fund that has a much wider variance of companies. They don't have to invest just in growth companies. They could invest in other types of companies. And we're putting the cart a little bit before the horse because we haven't discussed the different types of companies, defensive, cyclical, turnarounds, and the like, which we will in Chapter 5, so don't worry. It's one of the problems with doing mutual funds before you do stocks and bonds. But just suffice to say that a capital appreciation fund paints with a broad brush, so to speak, and looks for value and the opportunity to make money anywhere they can. And you have to know the difference. Some capital appreciation funds are just as risky as growth or aggressive growth, and others not so much. The well-known Fidelity Magellan Fund that was run by Mr. Peter Lynch, and we'll come back to Mr. Peter Lynch later on in the class, not in this class, but in the semester. He ran this Magellan Fund for 13 years or so and racked up 29% a year. Yeah, pretty darn good. And how did he do it? Well, because Magellan was a capital appreciation fund, he was able to invest in pretty much any type of company he wanted to. And that suited his particular style of investing very well. He had a knack for sniffing out value from companies, whether they were growing quickly or shrinking. The industry was shrinking, or they were in a turnaround phase. He was just very good at sniffing out undervalued companies. And so the capital appreciation model worked perfectly for him. You see what you're up against? In fact, one of the largest mutual funds in the nation is called the Growth Fund of America, and it's a capital appreciation fund. And you say, why did they do that? Well, it's not their fault. These terms came about after the name, after the mutual funds were in existence. So you see, it's not their fault. I mean, what do you want? You mean we got to change our name because you came up with a new category called capital appreciation? Indeed, that's how tricky the industry is. Slide number 43. Now we come to another category called growth and income. And personally, this is my favorite, folks. These are mutual funds that seek both long-term growth and current income, normally with an emphasis on capital gains. So, yes, we want companies that are growing, but we also want dividends, because income from stocks is dividends. And I like to think of this category as the pasta, as the meat, as the main entree, the potatoes. This is what you should have the main course on your plate, the most of on your plate. Sometimes the growth and income funds will augment their income with bonds, not usually. And here's where it gets tricky again. On the scramble sheet, you'll see that I tried to wrap growth and income with blend and value, because often they will call these blend funds, because it's a blend of growth and income or a growth and value. And then sometimes they will call these value funds. But be careful! In the industry, value often means something different depending on who you are discussing, who are you're talking with. Value funds, not always, but often are considered mutual funds that seek stocks that are undervalued in the market by investing in shares that have low PE multiples and high dividend. What are you talking about, Piano? We'll discuss PE, price to earnings ratio, in detail in Chapter 5 and then 6 and then later on. But for now, just know that the value funds, depending on who you're discussing or who you're talking with, try to find the companies that have been beaten up, that are out of favor, that nobody wants anymore. You with me? Yeah. And there are subtle differences between the three, the growth and income, the blend, the value, but they all tend to be lumped together. Sometimes you'll hear people call them core funds, meaning that these are important funds that should make up 40-50% or more of your portfolio. Personally, I like to start people off with growth and income, especially younger folks, but or folks who are a little bit worried about the downturns that invariably happen, because the growth and income funds will not go down as far as the aggressive growth, the capital appreciation funds. All things being equal, and they never are, these funds should hold up better than their counterparts that are more aggressive. Yeah, so I like to start off people with these guys, especially younger folks. Slide number 44. We are now at the bottom of the riskiest of stock funds. These are the least risky stock funds, realizing that all stock funds are risky, folks, but this category is called equity income. Now, why they use, I know why they use equity income, because equity means stocks and income means dividends. Why don't they just call them stock dividend funds? I don't know. I didn't make it up, so don't blame me. These are mutual funds that emphasize current income and capital preservation by investing primarily in high-yielding, income-producing common stocks. Common. We'll come back to that term later on, common stocks. What that means is that they're looking for companies that are boring. Yeah, food companies, railroads, utilities, real estate investment trusts. These are companies that are throwing off income. They're not growing very quickly. They're not going to shoot the lights out as the market zooms ahead. They're sitting in the corner just sort of doing their thing. But you're getting there, right? You're starting to understand. When the market hits a downturn, an air pocket, and everybody loses altitude, these mutual funds will lose less. In general, all other things being equal, and they never are. What happened to these things in the late 1990s is that they became very unpopular. Some of them were even going down. How could you go down in the late 1990s when the stock market was zooming in two directions, up and way up? Well, they had the old economy stocks. That was the term people used. Old economy. Who wants to invest in a railroad anymore? As if railroads are going to disappear. Yeah, and then guess what? Right, exactly. In the 2000 to 2000 bear market, they held up great. They did. Some of them went up because investors all of a sudden realized, you know what? You know, the food companies, that's, everybody's got to eat, right? But not everybody's got to use the internet. But guess what happened in 2008? Right, they got clobbered too. But instead of going down 50, 50, 60% as the growth and aggressive growth funds did, instead of going down 40% as the growth and income funds did, they went down 30%. Now, it's never fun to lose money, but it's a whole lot easier to lose 30% than it is to lose 70%. And what would we call these funds in our buffet? Oatmeal. Oatmeal. Is oatmeal exciting? No, it's kind of boring, but it's good for you. And just look what it does for horses. Right, horses eat oats, and look how majestic, beautiful animals they are. Sometimes the equity income funds will also invest in bonds if they feel that the stock prices have risen to levels that threaten the preservation of capital. Fancy way of saying don't lose too much money. But normally they will invest in stocks that pay dividends. This is one of my favorite funds for folks who are mature. Yeah, us old codgers. Once you get to the point where you really don't want to see the market drop 30, 50, 70%, you want to have that cushion. You still want some growth. Yeah, you still want some dividends. You want some stocks in your portfolio. But you don't want to roll the dice. I like equity income. Slide 45. Now, what we're going to do is add two more categories. Two more major categories. There are others. But what we're going to do is we're going to add the size of the company. That's called the capitalization. And we'll discuss market capitalization in detail in Chapter 5. And the domesticity. Where is the mutual fund based? Where the companies, where are they based that they invest in? And so what we find is that there are three major categories: large cap, mid cap, small cap. We're not talking about baseball caps, folks. We're talking about capitalization. We'll come back to that term later on. But just suffice to say that the largest companies are called large cap, the medium-sized companies mid-cap, and the smallest-sized companies are called small cap. Now, which do you think is the riskiest? I think you know the answer. Small companies are the riskiest. Right. Why? Because they don't have the roots as far deep into the economy as the large companies do. And so when the storm comes, they get uprooted pretty easily. But when things are going great, they're much more nimble. They can turn the company around to take advantage of more opportunities or newer opportunities than can larger companies. And of course, larger companies are going to be able to hold up better during downturns, but have that problem that they're just large companies. And the medium-sized companies are somewhere in between. Now, what do you think about the riskiness of domestic, global, and international? Now, remember the difference between global and international? Remember, global means everybody, including the United States. International means outside the United States. Right. 50 years ago, domestic mutual funds were far less riskier than their international counterparts, with global being somewhere in the middle. But that's not true anymore. It's simply not true because the world is global. Some domestic mutual funds may exhibit more risk, which we know is an imperfect measure, standard deviation, than some of their international counterparts. So that's not as clear-cut an issue as it used to be. So what happens here? So let's ignore this bottom here for now. What happens with the mutual fund company? Well, if you take a look at the scramble sheet, you'll see that the mutual fund companies played like Chinese menu. Pick one from column A, Chinese restaurant menu. One from column A, one from column B, and one from column C. And so, it's a global large cap growth fund. Or it's a domestic small cap aggressive growth fund. And of course, if one company has one, then they all have to have one. And so you see the huge explosion of all the different mutual funds, because if you know anything about statistics, you know, what's the permutation of three things taken five at a time and five things taken three? I can't remember my statistics that well. But in other words, there are just dozens and dozens and dozens of combinations, and then there are dozens of companies all doing dozens of combinations, and that's how we wound up with 11,000 mutual funds. Yes. Now, what's this last category here? Well, these are various categories that, you know, for the most part, folks, I hope you avoid for the most part, because they're not necessarily in your best interest, in my humble opinion. Mutual funds have started going abroad and now are regional. There might be a mutual fund that just invests in Canada or Japan or the Far East or Latin America. Why do we invest in mutual funds? Professional money management and diversification. Is this such a great idea? I don't think so. Now, that doesn't mean you might not know something about that particular area of the world. Say you've been in Latin America for the last 5 years, and you see that it's booming. Right now, they're struggling a little bit in Brazil, but Mexico's holding up pretty well. Peru's doing pretty darn well. Venezuela is going down the porcelain oasis. But you say, you know what, I'm going to put 10-20%, no more than 20, please, into a Latin American fund or a Far East fund, because I know they're doing well. Yeah, okay, all right, go ahead. But don't bet the farm, please. Emerging markets, sometimes called sub-emerging markets, are hot. Or at least they used to be until a couple years ago, and now they're cold, so now's probably a good time to invest in them. But it wasn't until the 1980s that there was significant interest at all in these markets, and the first emerging markets fund was going to be called the Third World Fund, if you can believe that, folks, if you can believe that. And they were soliciting interest from investment bankers and, you know, money managers in New York. And one guy got up and said, Mr. I forget who it was. I forget. I got to go back and read that. It was a great article. You don't understand. We're in the business to make money, not to help third world countries. But please do yourself a favor and come up with a better name for the fund. Come up with a better name for these markets. Hence the term emerging markets came about. And he was right about the name, but he was dead wrong about the making the money. It turns out the last 30 years, the emerging markets have been on a tear. Now, at any given time, they can lose 50% or more. They're very, very volatile. The Asian contagion in the late 1990s, some of those markets dropped 80-90%. Malaysia and Indonesia. But they've done very well for themselves, and I believe over the next 10, 20, 30 years, they will continue to do well, remembering that they will be very, very volatile. Now, what about sector funds? Sector funds are funds that invest in just a single industry, a single part of the economy. And for some of these, it makes sense because that part of the economy is absolutely enormous, like energy, like technology, like healthcare. But you can invest in mutual funds that just invest in the leisure companies, like the cruise ships and the like. That's not a good idea. I don't like this. I don't think it's a good idea. Unless you know something about the cruise ship industry and you know that business is booming and the bookings for the next 3 years are really phenomenal, go ahead, put 5-10% in. But please, not a whole lot, because we want diversification. Now, this last category on slide 45 is one that I just call dumb. Dumb. Why? Because these people believe that they can time the market. What does that mean? They see that the market's going to fall. Sell all your stocks. They see that the market's going to rise. Buy stocks now. Nobody has been able to accurately predict the short-term variations and movements of the stock market. there are plenty of people who can do it inaccurately, and some get paid very well for it. But nobody has been able to do it. And we'll discuss this in detail more as we get through the chapters on stocks. There was one company that everybody believed they did this in the 1990s, and it turns out they failed miserably. So if you hear anybody talk about market timing, or if it's in the name of the company, just mutual fund, just walk away. Slide 46. So we have gone through the stock mutual funds from the riskiest to the least riskiest, and then overlaid various categories on top of those. Now we're going to take a look at the bond funds. Now you would expect bond funds to be less volatile, and you would be right. They exhibit less standard deviation because bonds are just less risky than stocks. So what we're going to do is we're going to do the exact same thing. We're going to run from the riskiest bond funds to the least riskiest bond funds. The riskiest bond funds are high yield bond funds, often called junk. And why is that? Well, some of it is junk. We will discuss those later on when we get to bonds. But it turns out that high yield bond funds often act more like a stock fund. And there are reasons for that that we can discuss later on when we get to junk bonds, non-investment grade bonds, speculative bonds, distressed bonds. Why? Because when the economy improves, stocks usually do well. And if you're investing in bonds that are issued by companies that are in distress, the economy doing well is usually a good sign for those companies that they will be able to pay their bonds. Whereas when the economy does well, that's usually a bad indicator for bonds. Huh? Well, the economy doing well means that interest rates are going to go up. And what we're going to learn, interest rates going up is not fun for bonds. And bonds go down. Which is why some people who invest in bonds are often called ghouls. They want the economy to do poorly because interest rates will go down. We'll discuss this in detail later on. But just know that high-yield bond funds, junk bond funds, are the riskiest of bond funds. Should give you best return over time, but it's going to be a bumpy ride and you can wind up losing money. Corporate bond funds are typically bond funds that invest in high-quality corporate bonds. And we'll discuss what those are when we get to the chapters on bonds. But these are companies that are, solid. They're not going anywhere. They can pay their debts, no problem. There are convertible bonds, which sound really sexy, don't they? Convertibles, wind blowing through your... No. Nothing. It's not really that a big a part of the investment community. Investment universe, and they're really never really done that well for people, so just forget about them. And then we get down to municipal bonds. Municipal bonds are bonds that are issued by state and local governments and bridge authorities, water authorities, school districts. These are very popular with high net worth individuals, the 1%, so to speak. And why is that? Because the income is free from federal taxes. The states can't tax the feds can't tax the states. So if you invest in a municipal bond, you won't pay any federal income taxes. And if you're in a high net worth, if you're in a high tax bracket, that's worth a lot to you, which is why these things are mostly purchased by very wealthy individuals. If you buy a bond fund that is specific to your state, not only will you not pay any federal taxes, you will also not pay that state income tax. So for those of us who live in California, we would buy a California municipal bond fund, and we would not pay income tax to the state, to the feds, nor would we pay it to the state of California. Very, very cool. So once you're worth a few million dollars, and are making buku bucks, call me and we'll find a muni bond for you. Slide number 47. The least riskiest of the bond funds then are the bond funds that are backed by the U.S. of A. The government bonds, treasury bonds. Now, there are two categories. There's the U.S.-backed bonds that are created by entities such as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and no, they're not candy companies, a hot dog or hamburger place. No, they are very large institutions that provide liquidity, fancy way of saying money, to the housing markets. And the Congress spun these things off, I don't know, 40 years ago. There was never an explicit guarantee that the United States would back these things if they went belly up, if they got in trouble. But everybody believes that if they got in trouble, the United States government would come to the rescue. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened after the 2008 Great Recession. The United States government came to the rescue, and now you and I and all United States taxpayers are proud owners of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And although it's not usually a good idea for the government to have a business that is operating in the free market, just as Venezuela, they've actually been making lots of money for us, believe it or not. They have been contributing tons of money, billions of dollars, to the Treasury every year. And what we're going to do with these things is a political football. Nobody wants to touch them. The Republo rats and the demagogues don't want to do anything with these things because it's working. Don't break it. But they realize that something has to be done. You can't leave this thing forever. So we'll see what happens. And then there are the good old U.S. of A. Treasury bonds backed by the full faith and credit of the United States of America. And the cool thing about these is not only are they one of the most, if not the most, safest investment in the world, they are also free from state and local taxes. Because remember, the feds can't tax the states and the states can't tax the feds. Great. On top of these, from the riskiest to the least riskiest that we just went through, we were going to, just as we did with stocks, superimpose two more categories. Long-term, intermediate-term, and short-term. Now be careful. Long, large, short, small. You know, people tend to look at them and see the category that we saw back with stocks. No, there's nothing to do with these. They're totally unrelated. Long-term is the riskiest, and short-term is the least riskiest. And when you stop to think about it, it makes perfect sense. Is it riskier to lend your money to somebody for 30 years or 3 months or 2 years? You see, the longer the money's out there, the more risk for something bad to happen. So we should expect long-term bonds to pay more than short-term bonds, and intermediate term being somewhere in the middle. And that's exactly what we normally see. That's exactly what we normally see. And then domestic, global, international, yeah. So the same thing applies as did in the stock market, in the stock funds. Global is in between domestic and international. Domestic being less risky, international being more risky. Okay, great. So we've gone from the most riskiest stock funds down to the least riskiest stock funds, and then the most riskiest bond funds down to the least riskiest bond funds. What's next? Slide 48, balance funds. Balance funds are mutual funds whose objective is to generate a balanced return of both current income and long-term capital gains. They invest in both stocks and bonds. Normally about 50-50, 60-40, but the allocation can change as the investment environment changes. And you're probably thinking, wait a minute, Piano, if they invest in stocks and bonds, wouldn't they be somewhere in between the two with regard to risk, with regard to standard deviation? And it turns out, no. Why is that? It has to do with the fact that stocks and bonds often, but not always, move in different directions. When the stock market is doing well, it usually means that the economy is doing well. Interest rates rise. That's not good for bonds. Bonds go down, or at least stay the same. The converse is true. When the economy runs into a recession and earnings fall, stocks get hammered, but interest rates fall through various mechanisms. The demand for money is lessened, plus the Federal Reserve tries their best to knock down interest rates to stimulate the economy. And what does that do to bonds? It makes bonds worth more. Interest rates fall, bond prices rise. We'll discuss that in detail when we get to bonds. You've got to learn it, folks. And so it turns out that a balance fund smooths out the curves, smooths out the hills and valleys of investing in stocks and bonds. Very, very cool, folks. Very cool. And so for people who are really worried about losing money, but they have a long-term time horizon, this is where you place them. This is where you tell them, you know what, why don't you go with a balance fund? And I love the American Balance Fund. It's been around in one form or another since 1937. And in their prospectus, they state that the fund is managed as the complete U.S. investment program of a prudent investor. Doesn't that make you feel warm and fuzzy? Well, maybe not warm and fuzzy, but at least gives you, you know, in other words, you know, we're going to watch out for you. You know, we want you to succeed. We want you to do well. And that means stocks, but we also don't want you to scream and holler in the night or have a hard time sleeping at night. So we're going to invest in bonds too. And what they do is they make sure that they're never more than 75% stocks, 25% bonds, or less than 50% stocks, 50% bonds. Pretty cool, huh? Yeah. Balance funds, great, great choice. Okay, there's always got to be a catch, right? Now, there's another category called asset allocation funds, folks. And these get lumped into balance funds. But you got to be careful, folks. You got to be careful. These things can be closet market timers. They are mutual funds that spread investors' money across stocks, bonds, and money market securities, meaning cash investments, right? The short term, not going to lose the money. They are similar to balance funds in that they have a mix of investments, but the investment advisor often more diligently tries to fine-tune the allocation as market conditions change. Whereas a balance fund will usually stay 60-40, 50-50, you know, they'll veer a little bit depending on what goes on, but they're not going to go 100% stocks, 0% bonds, or 0% stocks and bonds and put everything into cash. This, to me, smacks of timing the market. And as we said, nobody can do it successfully. There's lots of people who can do it unsuccessfully. And some of them get paid very well, folks. So, in my humble opinion, you should shy away from the mutual funds that tell you they're going to allocate your assets dynamically. That doesn't mean they won't do well. They might do very, very well, and you might do well. But that's just my opinion, and of course I'm right, right? No, folks. No, I'm trying to tell you up front where my opinions are, so that you understand that, oh yeah, well, that's his Piano. Somebody else might say, no, look at this guy. They've done really, really well over 25 years, and they've allocated funds. They've allocated their assets very well, so stick with them. You see what you're up against? Yeah. Okay. Now, finally, we get to the very least riskiest of all funds, and those are called money market mutual funds. Now, we already discussed these, right, in Chapter 1. They invest in the short-term cash instruments such as treasury bills, commercial papers, bankers' acceptance notes. They are pretty much the same as what you'd get at a bank or a credit union, but what's the difference? Right, they are not guaranteed. Well, folks, you know, they aren't guaranteed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, but they are guaranteed. Why? Because if they ever lose money, and when they do, they lose a penny. If you don't believe me, just type in breaking the buck into any search engine, and you will see numerous case examples, articles about what happens when the mutual fund breaks the buck. The mutual fund company will go to the regulators and say, we're sorry, we screwed up, we broke the buck. Will you let us put our money into the mutual fund so that our investors don't lose any money? And the regulators say yes, of course, because normally that is verboten, folks. If you're handling somebody's money, you are never allowed to mix your money and their money. Even if you're giving them money, it's just not allowed. You can't do it. But here they have to say, you know, we screwed up, folks, and we need to make our investors whole, and they will do it. Now, if they can't do it, their competitors will do it. Their competitors will swoop in with the blessing of the regulators and say, we'll do it for you, you big dummies. Why? Well, think about it. They don't want anybody thinking that they're next. Right. So even though these things are not technically guaranteed, they basically are safe as putting it into a bank or a credit union. Now, a broker is not allowed to tell you that. They can't tell you that because they can lose their license. But when the 2008 debacle came about, this was September 2008 when the wheels were falling off of the economy, one company had two mutual funds that lost a penny and the other one I think lost 3 cents. And oh my lord, the alarm bells started running, screaming and hollering and gnashing of teeth. And the Federal Reserve Bank, not the United States government, the Federal Reserve Bank, which is authorized by the government, which is a separate entity, it's the Bankers Bank, they ran in on their white horse and said, we'll backstop any mutual fund, money market mutual fund, for the next 6 months. And sure enough, that quieted people's nerves for about 4 weeks. And then everything else fell apart. And then 6 months later, they renewed it for another 6 months. And by that time, in late 2009, it was evident that the money market mutual funds were not in danger of wholesale slaughter. So even though they're not guaranteed, folks, they're pretty darn close. And if you are interested, do check out Breaking the Buck. It's some very, very good reading, very interesting reading how these things work. Slide 51. Mutual funds of mutual funds. You know it had to happen, right? Well, no, hang on a minute, Payano, okay? Yeah, I know you. These are very popular. Why? Because of 401k plans and 403b plans. What you do with these is you tell your company, hey, I'm going to retire in 2050 or 2035. And so you choose the target date, retirement date. The lifestyle fund is what the thrift savings plan calls it. I like Fidelity calls it the freedom fund, freedom 50-50, or 2050, I'm sorry, not 50-50. And what they do is they populate the mutual fund with other mutual funds to match your time horizon. You understand? Yeah, I see what's going on. And as you get closer and closer to your target date, to your retirement, to your freedom, then they become more and more risk-averse. They start moving the allocation from the riskiest down to the least riskiest. You understand? And why are they so popular? Well, because of 401k plans. If you start working at a company, that company is allowed to automatically enroll you in your 401k plan. And as long as they have these target date, lifestyle, freedom funds, whatever you want to call them, and they match the date with your birthday, then you can't sue them for bad investment advice. The Congress gave them a safe harbor, it is often called. And so now, obviously, if it's a company of any size, and they want to have a 401k plan, and they want their employees to contribute, because they don't want to deal with them when they're old and aged, then they'll put them in the appropriate target date fund. Cool. And some of them do very, very well. And some of them, not so well, like every other mutual fund. Slide 52. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Let's not spend too much time on this slide, Payano. Specialty funds. Hedge funds. Well, first of all, hedge funds are legally not mutual funds. Stay away from these things, folks. Unless you got a lot of money to lose. Because some of them do really, really well. Most of them stink up the joint. And there are thousands of these hedge funds now. Maybe there's fewer because a lot of them have folded in the last couple of years. There's no regulatory oversight. They can put all your money in one company. They can do exotic strategies such as shorting and whatever that is. Wait till the end of the semester. You don't want to know now. And they have exorbitant fees. 1 to 2% annual operating expenses
Plus, they take 20% of your profits.
What?
Stay away. Now, these were traditionally only open to sophisticated investors, which means people who had $1 million or made over $200,000 a year. This is when $1 million was something. This was 50, 60 years ago. Now it's, $1 million ain't nothing to sneeze at, but some houses in San Diego are $1 million, and somebody who bought it 40 years ago is now a millionaire and never expected to become a millionaire. So stay away from these things. Bear funds are mutual funds that try to make money when the stocks go down. It's kind of hard to do because stocks go up about 3 years for every 1 year or 2 years they go down, so it's not easy to do, and plus you're hoping that things go bad, and I don't like that. We'll discuss gold and other precious metals and hard assets later on. If you believe the world is going to end, go ahead, buy gold, but then if the world ends, you can't collect. Real estate investment trusts are actually great ways to become a real estate investor without ever having to deal with a tenant or a toilet. The problem with these funds is that they are sector funds, and there ain't that many REITs out there, folks, so you're basically buying all the good companies and the bad companies at the same time. And then there are hundreds, probably, I don't know, maybe not thousands, but there are the hundreds of these boutique, exotic funds. And I kid you not, folks, all you gotta do is type in funny funds or weird funds or funds out of the ordinary into any search engine, and you'll see plenty of articles on this. There's one fund called the Stock Car Stocks Fund. Now, what do you think they invest in? Yeah, NASCAR. And I have a hard time believing this, but NASCAR is the most popular spectator sport in the United States of America, folks. People, 200,000, 100,000 on a Sunday afternoon, go out and watch people drive around the track at 200 miles an hour in a big circle. And what do you see on those cars and on those baseball caps and on those shirts and jackets? Plenty of advertising, and these people are fanatical. If Folgers is the coffee, official coffee of NASCAR, that's the coffee they drink. And so the Stock Car Stocks Funds goes out and buys those companies. Uh-huh. How about the Paws Tombstone Fund? What do they invest in? Well, Paws is the name of the companies. Tombstone is the name of their fund. They invested in mortuaries and casket companies and embalming. Well, everybody's going to die someday. And thankfully, so did the Paws Tombstone Fund. And then, folks, I am not making this up. You can't make these things up. Fact is always stranger than fiction. There was a fund called the Chicken Little Growth Fund for people who were worried that the sky was falling. You don't believe me. I know you don't believe. Type it in into the search engine of your choice, and you will see that I am not making this up. There is a Timothy Fund for good Christians, because there's something in there about in the letter from St. Paul to Timothy about being a good capitalist Christian. And I always say, no, don't separate the two, folks. This is Caesar. This is, anyway, you've heard me say that already. Anyway, so the choices are endless, and so are the fees. Stay away from them. Go with mainstream companies, mutual funds that have been around for years, tried and true, good times and bad times. Continuing. All right, now, we have to spend a little bit of time on index funds. Why? Because index funds are becoming very important. And there are people who will tell you that you should only buy index funds. Now, I don't know about you, but any time in the investment world people say you should only do this, I tend to run away, because there's no such thing. Everybody's different. All investments are different. All investments have advantages. All investments have disadvantages. And index funds are no different than any other investment. They have advantages and disadvantages. They are also called passively managed. I want you to remember that. These are mutual funds that buy and hold a portfolio of stocks or bonds equivalent to those in a specific index. There is no active management performed, no research. As we described in the previous presentation, they only buy all the stocks in the S&P 500, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the Russell 2000. Why? They can offer much lower annual fees. Well, there's no research. And, as we said, many of the actively managed funds do not beat the market. Well, there's various reasons for that. Because of the annual fee, an index fund cannot actually match the market's performance, but it should come very close. As we saw in the previous presentation where the Index 500 fund was a little bit less than the Standard & Poor's 500. Whereas an actively managed fund could substantially outperform or underperform the market index. And we saw two actively managed funds that outperformed. One did it handsomely. And we saw one actively managed fund that underperformed the market very badly. Okay. So, what's the rationale? Well, the rationale for index funds came from research done in the early 1970s, late 1960s, that statistically showed that many of the actively managed funds did not beat the market. They said, you do better simply throwing a monkey throwing darts at a dartboard would do better. But the truth is that many actively managed funds that have been around for decades do beat their respective indices over time. You want to look for a fund family where most all funds have done this over decades. And we'll discuss these in the next presentation. There are only a few major companies that have consistently. Now, in any company, they'll have one or two mutual funds that have done really, really well. And there's something for you to look at. Don't get me wrong. But I like to look at it at the entire company and see how they do. And index funds can become a victim of their own success. And it's very hard to counteract this industry drumbeat. Because the industry now, the financial journalism industry, has come up with this idea that index funds are the way to go. Actively managed funds are going to disappear. They're outlived their usefulness. And it's just not true. Slide number 55. Here are just some of the indices that we will discuss in Chapter 5. So we're on slide 55, and we're getting a little ahead of ourselves. So don't worry about these. But when I ask you to research your mutual funds, and also ask you to research the thrift savings plan, these indices are going to pop up. A few of these indices are going to pop up, and you'll see them. And if you find them, great. And if you don't find them, don't worry about it. Do your best. As we said, many people will tell you that index funds are the current perfect investment. Visit ifa.com, Index Fund Advisors. And well, of course, they're advising you on which index fund to buy, and you're going to pay them. So they're telling you they're the perfect investment. I'm going to tell you there is no perfect investment, okay? No investment is perfect. Every investment has advantages, every investment has disadvantages, and it is up to you to scout out and understand those and deal with them, because nothing's perfect, folks. Nothing. Slide 56. Now, here's a slide that's going to make more sense when we are done stocks and bonds. We're going to come back to this slide. But right now, it might not make any sense to you, but that's okay. Indexes sometimes become skewed, bent out of shape toward a particular sector of the economy or region of the world. And so here are two very popular indices. This is called the EFA, the MSCI, Morgan Stanley Capital International. You don't have to remember that. And EFA stands for Europe, Australia, and the Far East. It's the international index that was used for 30-some-odd years, 40 years, and now it's giving way to another one. It's being replaced by another index, which we'll take a look at in Chapter 5. And then here's the Standard & Poor's 500 that's still very, very popular, the 500 largest companies in the United States. And what happened? Well, in the 1980s, many of you weren't even around yet, but I was, and people were worried that Japan was going to take over the world, right? Now it's China, right? Japan's stock market skyrocketed. So did the real estate. And at the end of the 1980s, on December 31st, 1989, you bought the EFA index thinking that you were getting a broad representation of all the stocks in Europe, Australia, and the Far East, the international stocks. But really, what you were buying was fully 60% Japan. you're buying mostly the Japan stock market. 40% Europe, Australia, and Singapore, Hong Kong, and the other places in the Far East. You didn't know this unless you dug deep into the index. And the PE, the price-to-earnings ratio, was 51.9. Now, again, you don't know what PE stands for yet. We're not there at Chapter 5. But you will. And you'll know that 51.9 is very, very high. Whereas everybody else was 13. Which is, you know, a little on the low side. Not too low, but a little on the low side. And we'll learn about this in detail later on. The Japanese stock market then went on to lose over 80% of its value over the next 12 years, 13 years. Indeed. So you thought you were getting a broad representation of the international market, and you weren't. The same thing happened at the end of the 1990s. The tech industry, internet, computers, software, wireless technology. These exploded. The NASDAQ went up, you know, what was it? It went to up 100%, almost 100% in 85% in 1 year. And you thought when you bought the S&P 500 at the peak of the market, March 31st, 2000, that you were getting a broad representation of United States stocks, but you were buying one-third information technology stocks with a PE of 59, higher than Japan's. Everything else, I mean everything else, energy, healthcare, housing, food, railroads, everything else, folks, old economy, was still a high PE. 19 is pretty high, but was a lot less than the information technology. The information technology sector then went on to lose 80% of its value over the next 2.5 years until October of 2002, when the market fell about 50%. The S&P fell almost 50%, but the information technology sector fell 80%. So you see, indexes can become out of whack, and you have to be... you have to be aware of this. And the reason, one of the reasons I really don't like index funds is because you're hamstringing your money manager. I want my money manager to be able to use judgment. And this is something that Mr. Benjamin Graham said decades ago. You want to eschew, means avoid, any strategy that simply says, do this. When this happens, do that. And that's what index funds do. If a company does well and the stock market rewards it by going up higher, then the index fund must buy more of those shares, which drives the company higher, which then is a feedback loop. The index fund must buy more because it represents more of the index. And so you pump up the balloon, and then what happens? You know what happens, it bursts, and then as the company falls, the index fund must sell more. That's the wrong way to invest, in my humble opinion. If a company, whether it's a good company, this happened to Apple in 2012 or so, it just kept going up and up and up, and the index funds had to buy more and more shares. Whereas my money manager, I want them to be able to, or me if I'm the money manager, I want to look, Apple's a great company, but folks, it's way overpriced. And then Apple fell hard. It lost over 50% of its value. And the stock index fund manager, what do they have to do? They have to sell. They have no choice. Whereas an actively managed fund can say, oh, great, it's a bargain. Apple's now finally at a price that I'm willing to pay for it. Are you with me? You understand what I'm saying? Many people would counter by saying, but that only happens every once in a while. Yeah, but when it happens hard, like it did in Japan in the 1980s, and as it did in the internet and technology stocks in the late 1990s. So, there. Now you know that index funds are not perfect, and you can have a good debate with people who are already convinced otherwise, so don't worry, you won't change their minds. Slide 57. And this brings us to exchange-traded funds, ETFs. See, ETFs started about 25 years ago, and they were and still mostly are index funds. And the idea was, hey, let's create an index fund that we can trade on the stock exchange. So it looks like an open-ended fund. They can always add more shares, but it trades like a closed-end fund. It's a hybrid. And what people can do with them is they can buy and sell them throughout the day, unlike a mutual fund. An actively managed open-end mutual fund, you buy it, and you have one price at the end of the day. As we said, you know, at the end of the day, they have to come up with a net asset value. But the ETFs are like stocks. You can buy them and sell them all day long. And some people have been doing that. They've been using them as trading vehicles, which is the loser's game, which we've already talked about. Don't do it. If you want to buy an ETF, buy it like any other mutual fund for the long term, $50, $100 a month, or however much you have. Great. ETFs are mostly, as we said, all in passively managed index funds. But now there are some actively managed funds. So they're ETFs, but their fees are going to be higher. Why? Because they've got people knocking on the doors of GM and Ford and Chrysler and deciding which one to buy, or Walmart or Target or Costco. They've got to make decisions about investments. The best part of the ETFs are the names. Spiders and diamonds and cubes. I mean, Spider is the S&P 500. Diamond is the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Cube is the NASDAQ, because there's a bunch of Qs, Q cubes. You'll see if you are so inclined. Slide 58. Just a couple more slides. Couple more slides, folks. Stick with us. Socially responsible funds. Huh? Well, these started out actually quite some time ago, before the term socially responsible funds was even in existence. These are mutual funds that actively and directly incorporate ethics and morality into the investment decisions. They started out with some funds refusing to invest in companies that sold alcohol and tobacco. And some of these funds have been around for decades, folks. We're talking back in the 50s and the 30s. I mean, some of these funds have just decided that they weren't going to make money off of alcohol and tobacco. Then in the 70s and 80s, it moved to companies that don't pollute and build weapons or nuclear power plants or destroy the rainforest, and then the companies that exploit labor. It's surprising that there are any companies left to invest in. But silliness aside, many social responsible funds have actually done quite well for their investors. And what do they attribute this to? The conventional wisdom is that because the technology companies are the cleaner companies and they're treat their employees better, and they've been the ones that have done the best over the last 30 some years or so, because, you know, it's been their time to shine and growth. And slide 59, socially irresponsible funds. You can't make this stuff up, folks. Possibly as a backlash to socially responsible funds and their perceived political overtones, there now is a mutual fund called the Vice Fund. I mean, it had to happen, right? And yes, you guessed it, they love tobacco and alcohol, Philip Morris and Anheuser-Busch, which is now called InBev, I'm not sure, it's a global company now, and gambling and defense firms. And although it's a very small fund with high fees, it's actually done quite well for its investors. They've changed the name, although the website still works, vicefund.com. Now called the Barrier Fund. I'm not sure exactly why. I think because there are barriers to entry. It's hard to come up with a new alcohol. I don't know. But the strategy and manager, at least according to the website, have not changed. So if you love gambling, you love tobacco, alcohol, this is your fund. Slide 60. Folks, these are just some more of the various types of funds that are out there, folks. So, as I said, we're only scratching the surface. So what do I want you to do? Not be overwhelmed by the sip from the fire hose. I want you to concentrate on the ones that are on the scramble sheet in the presentation and know those categories, realizing that there's a whole lot more out there for you to play with. So in any time you so decide to. Anytime you choose, there's a whole lot more to learn. That's the best part about investing. In my humble opinion, you'll never run out of things to learn. It's such a huge industry. So many options. Slide 61. Our last slide, and we're going to break. Are you exhausted? You go back and do it in pieces. There's a company called Morningstar. It's normally called Lipper. Actually, I like Lipper better. Lipper is more expensive. You got to go to the library. Morningstar has a website where they try to get you to sign up. Every time you turn around, they're trying to get you to sign up for premium. And they did their best to popularize a mutual fund financial and journalism. So much so that they created these style boxes that further helped to balkanize the industry, to break up the industry, because they separated mutual funds into value versus growth, and then blend in the middle, and then large, medium, small, and so everybody, you had to have one fund in all nine boxes, and these style boxes are supposedly fabulous. At least Morningstar says that they are. No one I know uses them. I never have. And now, instead of just the style boxes, they have these ownership zones, which is, instead of a box, it's an oval, but they say they're even better. Go right ahead and play on Morningstar, because I'm going to ask you to research a couple of mutual funds, download their annual reports, and Morningstar and Lipper are the two major places where you get information, plus the mutual fund itself. Again, go to the library. It's free there. Or, you know, check out their website and just be careful. Don't sign up for $40 a month. Now, this has been one of our longer presentations, haven't it? Yes, it is. And there's a lot involved. So go back over, listen to it again, watch it again, study the different categories. You're the expert now, folks. You know more, vastly more than your family and friends, and they're counting on you. We want you to be awesome. Bring honor and glory to Southwestern Community College, and don't forget to tell them where you learned it, right? WonderProfessor.com, Business 123, Introduction to Investments. See you in our final presentation on mutual funds, where we actually ask the question, how do I choose a mutual fund?